In the second chapter of the Gospel of Mark, to a group of Pharisees who had confronted him regarding what they perceived to be a clear violation of the Sabbath command, Jesus declared this: "The Sabbath was made for man, and not man for the Sabbath." So these were religious leaders who had claimed to be teachers of God's law, and they should have known why this Sabbath that they observed and that they claimed to reverence, that they taught others to observe and to reverence, why it was created, why it had been instituted. But what Christ declared to them here was a radical departure, a reorientation, really, of all that they had understood of the meaning and the intent of the day that God had given to man. But they just didn't get it. They couldn't get it. You might as well have been speaking another language to them because it wasn't in their comprehension. How did they get there? How did they get to this place so far removed from the original intent of God's Sabbath? How did they get so far off track? I want to talk about that today, about the history of the Sabbath, and man's relationship to it and with it. And I want to talk about the true intent of the Sabbath, this rest that we've been given as our God designed it, and how it should, how it must inform our observing of it today as his people, lest we fall into the same error that they did. If you're looking for a title, it's this: The Sabbath, Delighting in Relationship. The Sabbath, Delighting in Relationship. Turn, if you would, over to Genesis 2. Genesis chapter 2. Here in Genesis 2, after the account of the 6 days of creation, we read this. Genesis 2 and verse 1. "Thus the heavens and the earth and all the host of them were finished, and on the seventh day God ended his work which he had done, and he rested on the seventh day from all of his work which he had done. And then God blessed the seventh day and sanctified it, because in it he rested from all of his work which God had created and made." And so here we read of a God who doesn't need to rest, who set aside a day, not for himself, but to mark it, right? Sanctifying it as special, as set aside, to be a blessing for his creation. But rather than experience it as the blessing that he intended, the history of man, as we know from God's word, is one of either of two reactions, both opposing sides of the ditch. On one side of the ditch, we see a blatant disregard, a rejection of the sanctity of the Sabbath. Well, on the other side of the ditch, a corruption of the meaning and the intent of the Sabbath, turning it into a rigid, burdensome list of rules and regulations by which religious leaders sought to exercise dominance and exercise control over the people. Both extremes demonstrate a profound misunderstanding and misapplication, really a defilement, if you would, of the original, the true intent of the Sabbath as our Lord instituted it, turning into what intended to be a blessing into a burden. Now, there's not a great deal of evidence for the observance of the Sabbath in the scripture prior to it being codified as part of the covenant that was made at Sinai between God and Israel. But though there isn't much, there is evidence. I won't take time to cover that in detail. It could be a study on its own behalf. I'll just reference a few passages in general. In Genesis 26:5, we find that Abraham, it said of him that he observed all the commandments of God, his statutes. And in Exodus 16, verse 23, it indicates that the Sabbath, as well as other commandments of God, was well known and observed prior to the giving of the law at Sinai. Turn over, if you would, to Deuteronomy 5. Deuteronomy chapter 5. At Sinai, you know, a loving God reiterated those laws he reiterated it for their good to his people, who he had delivered from slavery. He shared them with them. He wanted them to be able to enter into relationship with him. And those laws, if they were to keep them, if they truly understood them, as he intended, would serve to protect and to guide a holy people in an unholy world, in the wilderness of the world that they were in, both as they traveled there and throughout, even into the future. And here in Deuteronomy 5, verse 12, we read, Deuteronomy 5, verse 12, "Observe the Sabbath day to keep it holy. As the Lord your God commanded you, 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord your God. In it you shall do no work, you nor your son, nor your daughter, nor your male servant, nor your female servant, nor your ox, nor your donkey, nor any of your cattle, nor your stranger who is within your gates, that your male servant and your female servant may rest as well as you. And remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, and the Lord your God brought you out from there by a mighty hand and by an outstretched arm. Therefore, the Lord your God commanded you to keep the Sabbath day." And so God says, you know, in my love for you, I delivered you from slavery, from bondage, from the toil and the bondage that you suffered under the hand of the Egyptians. Therefore, in remembrance of that, I've given you this day to observe the Sabbath that I've given you. And God reveals here that the Sabbath is very much about a release from slavery, in reality for them, but one that actually symbolizes a release from slavery and bondage in a spiritual sense. It's about, very much about, restoration and healing. And God delivered them from a life of this burdensome servitude to an evil, uncaring taskmasters into a relationship with a God who loved them, who offered them rest, who offered them that healing, both physical and spiritually, who offered them relationship in his family. And the Sabbath he gave was to be a special sign for them that would identify them as his people, who had been liberated from slavery and brought into that relationship. It was to be their identity. It signified who they were. Turn, if you would, over to Ezekiel 20. Ezekiel 20. We know that it was not long before the children of Israel went astray of God's desire, his will for them, and their response to what he had given to them to be for their good. They had that first response that we discussed, that rejection of his law, his commandments. They rejected and they spurned the sanctity of the Sabbath. And here in Ezekiel 20, in verse 10, we read, "Therefore I made them go out of the land of Egypt and brought them into the wilderness, and I gave them my statutes and I showed them my judgments, which if a man does, he shall live by them. Moreover, I also gave them my Sabbaths to be a sign between them and me, that they might know that I am the Lord who sanctifies them. Yet the house of Israel rebelled against me in the wilderness. They did not walk in my statutes. They despised my judgments, which if a man does, he shall live by them. And they greatly defiled my Sabbaths." And so, as we know, ultimately, we know what came of them because of their rejection of God's Sabbath and his other commands. God removed his blessing from them. And the rest of what God had provided for them came swiftly to an end. And we're familiar with the history. We know the northern tribes of Israel were taken into captivity in Assyria, never again to return to the promised land. We know that the southern tribe of Judah was taken into captivity in Babylon, where they were for approximately 70 years, after which they were allowed to return to their homeland. It's believed around 538 BC by Cyrus the Great, the king of Persia. Turn, if you would, over to Ezra 6. Let's spend some time talking about their actions at that return. Here in Ezra 6, we see a reset of sorts. Really, it was an attempt to restore what had been lost, an attempt to restore their land as it had been, to restore the temple, and really to try to attempt to restore somewhat of a relationship with their God. But Israel being Israel, merely men being men, their attempts, though as we see are initially very, you know, commendable, ultimately those attempts fell short, as we'll see. Where the Israelites prior to captivity erred on that side, as we said, of the ditch of rejection, of disobedience, we see a post-exilic Judah ultimately headed straight to that other ditch. And there were some signs that was to be the outcome. That was the direction it was heading from the very beginning of their efforts. The books of Ezra and Nehemiah provide us an account of the return of Judah to their homeland, the rebuilding of the temple, and their efforts to govern themselves according to God's law. And they were full of zeal. And that was actually very commendable to see them. And God honored their efforts. And we often point to their story as examples of zeal and a desire to restore and have a relationship with God. And here in Ezra 6, we read, Ezra 6, verse 15, says, "Now the temple was finished on the third day of the month of Adar, which was in the sixth year of the reign of King Darius. And then the children of Israel, the priests and the Levites and the rest of the descendants of the captivity celebrated the dedication of this house of God with joy. And they offered sacrifices at the dedication of this house of God, 100 bulls, 200 rams, 400 lambs, and as a sin offering for all Israel, 12 male goats, according to the number of the tribes of Israel. And they assigned the priests to their divisions and the Levites to their divisions over the service of God in Jerusalem, as it is written in the book of Moses." And so the returning Jews began a good faith effort to restore what had been lost while they were in captivity. But yet with all that seemed to be good, and there was plenty of good, plenty of praise for them to be had, there were some indications, as I said at the outset, that things were beginning to go off track. And they went off track really in a couple ways. The first concerning turn of events we see here in Ezra 7. Ezra 7, if you'll turn there in verse 25. Here Artaxerxes, the king of Persia, that succeeded Cyrus and then his successor Darius, they continued their support of the Jewish efforts to restore their homeland and their religion. But they went a little to the extreme, it seems. Toward that end, they promoted the establishment of additional laws and decrees from Persia about not only their own laws, but also pertaining to the laws of God, the laws of the Jews. Here in Ezra 7, verse 25, we read this. It says, "And you, Ezra, according to your God-given wisdom, set magistrates and judges who may judge all the people who are in the region beyond the river, all such as know the laws of your God and teach those who do not know them. Whoever will not observe the law of your God and the law of the king, let judgment be executed speedily upon him, whether it be death or banishment or confiscation of goods or imprisonment." And so, here we see obedience to the law of God becoming a matter not of a covenantal relationship with God, but a civic compulsion enforced by a decree from the Persian government. Do you see a problem there, potentially, with where this could go? And we'll see that it was to have ramifications where things would go from here. And so that was the first indication that something may be beginning to go off track. The second indication that this restoration was maybe headed in a wrong direction is found in Ezra 9. You'll turn over there, Ezra 9. It's a subtle point, but it's important, I think. Here, after it came to light that some intermarriage had occurred between the pagan people of the land and the Jews, there was an effort made, again, very zealous, made to make things right and to restore obedience to God in that matter. And you know, again, the desire to remove sin was very from their midst was admirable. But notice the motivation here in Ezra 9, verse 13. "And after all had come upon us for our evil deeds, for our our great guilt. Since you, our God, have punished us less than our iniquities deserve and have given us such deliverance as this, should we again break your commandments and join in marriage with the people committing these abominations? Would you not be angry with us until you had consumed us so that there would be no remnant or survivor? O Lord God of Israel, you are righteous, for we are left as a remnant as it is to this day. Here we are before you in our guilt, though no one can stand before you because of this. Notice, if you read in here between the lines, the motivation that's given for their desire to be cleansed, to be purified in this matter. Fear. Fear. Fear of breaking God's commandments. Why? Out of reverence, a right fear? Because they didn't want to sever their relationship with their God? Because they were concerned about being cut off from relationship and losing that relationship? We don't really read that here, do we? What we read here is a fear that God would consume them, punish them again for their disobedience. Again, it was a motivation based on a desire for self-preservation, to appease rather than to please a God with whom they'd shared a special relationship. What we read here seems to be the development of a relationship not much different than that of the people around them with the pagan gods that they worshipped, one that is arbitrary and capricious and trying to appease their gods. It didn't start that way. We see some good things here. We see an attitude of wanting to be right. But again, there's a subtle motivation that I think does not bode well for the future that we see as things continued on into the future. Turn ahead, if you would, to Nehemiah 10. Here in Nehemiah 10, the people of Judah came together to commit themselves to observe all of the commandments of God that had been restored to them after captivity and to make a commitment. Nehemiah 10, verse 28. We read this: Now the rest of the people, the priests, the Levites, the gatekeepers, the singers, the Nethinim, and all those who had separated themselves from the peoples of the land to the law of God, their wives, their sons, and their daughters, everyone who had knowledge and understanding, these joined with their brethren, their nobles, and they entered into a curse and an oath to walk in God's law, which was given by Moses, the servant of God, and to observe and do all the commandments of the Lord our God, and his ordinances and his statutes. Again, on the surface, anyway, admirable. The desire they had to restore what had been lost. But again, here's the rub. We know that the agreement the people entered into here, though admirable, and though God, at least as we see initially, seemed to bless their efforts, the agreement, it could not signify a new covenant between God and the people. That time had passed. God had issued them a writ of divorce because of their disobedience and rejection of his law. God's presence had long since left the temple. And so it was a different kind of a commitment that they entered in here. Here the people were, rather than establishing a relationship, were really, as it turned out in reality, as we see as time goes on, with the help of the Persian civil government, codifying a religious system, in a sense, of government. Not the heart they started with, but that's the premise, and that's where it began, and that's where it ultimately, as we'll see reading on, it led. And within this construct, we read in verse 32 and verse 35 of Nehemiah 10, they began to make ordinances, they began to make regulations, regulating various aspects of temple worship, regulating various aspects of Sabbath observance. But because, again, these were premised on a covenantal, were not premised on a covenantal construct of relationship, as time went on and we see, they became an unmanageable, burdensome morass of regulations, piled upon regulations, a legalistic list of do's and don'ts. What they ended up building was not a relationship, but a religion. And to give you a sense of what that religion system ultimately became, I want to read an excerpt from one of the United Church of God's booklets titled God's Sabbath Rest, Sunset to Sunset. We've heard much of this before, but I don't know about you, it never ceases to amaze me how it devolved over time. The religious code regarding the Sabbath listed 39 principal classes of prohibited actions: sowing, plowing, reaping, gathering into sheaves, threshing, winnowing, cleansing, grinding, sifting, kneading, baking. Each of these chief enactments was further discussed and elaborated so that actually there were several hundred things a conscientious, law-abiding Jew could not do on the Sabbath. According to first century rabbinic opinion, the prohibition against plowing could be violated by simply spitting on the ground. The spit could disturb the soil, which in the rabbi's view was a type of plowing. Women were forbidden to look into a mirror on the Sabbath because they might see a gray hair and pull it out, and that would constitute work. Wearing nailed shoes on the Sabbath was prohibited because in the authorities' view, the addition of nails meant they were carrying an unnecessary burden. Even walking on the grass was not allowed because some of the grass might be bent and broken, which constituted threshing, one of the forbidden categories of work. The religious leaders taught that if a house caught on fire on the Sabbath, its inhabitants couldn't carry their clothes out of the house to spare them from the flames because that would be bearing a burden. However, they were allowed to put on all the layers of clothing they could wear and thus remove the clothes by wearing them, which was deemed acceptable. Ludicrous. But this is where man, left to their own devices outside of relationship, creating a religion, will tend to go. A blessing? A delight? No. An oppressive, burdensome system of religious, legalistic ritualism. Pretty clear this system was not intended to make men and women servants, or it was intended to make men and women servants and slaves to the Sabbath. Turn, if you would, to Mark 2. Into this legalistic religious system came Jesus Christ, our Lord. And Christ, as we know, came preaching what seemed to leaders and to people living under that system radical. Radical. Not a radical departure from what God had originally intended, but a radical departure from what the religion that had devolved from over time, from what God intended. And because the Sabbath command, you know, perhaps it's the most visible of all the commands that God had originally given, it was Jesus' actions around the observance of the Sabbath that became such a sticking point, a point of contention, drawing most of the attention and ire of the religious leaders of that day, the Pharisees and the Sadducees. And the gospel, as we know, records a number of incidents of Christ's quoted, you know, quote-unquote radical interpretation and teaching that ran afoul of the religion of their day. Here in Mark 2, verse 23, we read of one such incident. Mark 2, reading in verse 23, says, "Now it happened that he went through the grain fields on the Sabbath, and as they went, his disciples began to pluck the heads of grain, and the Pharisees said to him, 'Look, why do they do what is not lawful on the Sabbath?' But he said to them, 'Have you never read what David did when he was in need and hungry? He and those with him, how he went into the house of God in the days of Abiathar and the high priest and ate the showbread, which is not lawful to eat except for the priests, and also gave some of those to those who were with him.' And he said to them," Jesus said to them, "the Sabbath was made for man, and not man for the Sabbath. Therefore the Son of Man is also Lord of the Sabbath." The Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. Shocking. A shocking statement to their ears from their perspective, for sure. Jesus is saying it was I who instituted the Sabbath. There's a bomb right there, right? Stating who he was and the authority that he had. And he says, you know, I didn't give it to man to demand servitude to a ritual, religious practice and duty. It's not a tool for you to exercise control and to maintain control over the people. It's a time my Father and I have given for rest, both physical and spiritual, so that the children of Israel, the children of God, who share that relationship the Father and I have given to them can focus on it and rejoice in it. This is not your time to use. This is time for the family. You don't get it, is what he's saying. Radical. Radical. Turn, if you would, to Matthew 11. Beginning here in Matthew 11, the author of this gospel account reveals how Jesus used his ministry to reorient their thinking back toward the true meaning of the Sabbath, about resting in him, resting in relationship, and all that that means. Matthew 11, verse 28, Christ says this. He says, "Come to me, all you who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and lowly in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light." As he had done so long ago, Christ here reveals his desire and his intention to release those who are enslaved from their burden under the servitude to the God of this world and its political and its religious systems. He offers them here an opportunity to find rest, both spiritual and physical rest in relationship with him. "Come to me, I will give you rest." And everything he did while he was on this earth, including his example, you know, surrounding the Sabbath, was pointed at driving home that point. The purpose that had been true since creation. Initially, his purpose for man and his purpose in the symbolism of the Sabbath of pointing to not only the physical rest that he provided there in this physical life, but to the spiritual rest that they could look forward to for eternity. Continuing on in Matthew 12, he continues to drive home that point. Matthew 12, beginning in verse 1, we read, "At that time Jesus went through the grain fields on the Sabbath, and his disciples were hungry and began to pluck the heads of grain and to eat. And when the Pharisees saw it, they said to him, 'Look, your disciples are doing what is not lawful to do on the Sabbath.' But verse 3, he said to them, 'Have you not read what David did when he was hungry, he and those who were with him? How he entered the house of God and ate the showbread, which was not lawful for him to eat, nor for those who were with him, but only for the priests. Or have you not read in the law that on the Sabbath the priests in the temple profane the Sabbath and are blameless? Yet I say to you that in this place there is one greater than the temple. But if you had known what this means, 'I desire mercy and not sacrifice,' you would not have condemned the guiltless. For the Son of Man is Lord, even of the Sabbath." So now, technically speaking, what David did here in taking of the showbread was not lawful, according to the strict interpretation of the law, the letter of the law. And Jesus references what David had done to argue about the need for mercy and that the need for mercy superseded the ritual law in times of desperate necessity. And to show that while the act was technically unlawful, it was justifiable under these extreme circumstances, making it a moment of compassion over ceremony. It's the kind of flexibility that can only be understood in the context of relationship, right? Of a relationship between God and his people. Christ says here he desires mercy and not sacrifice. And it's the kind of loving mercy that one shows toward another one who is in need, not the cold, rigid, uncaring sacrifice demanded by a set of rigid, unbending rules enforced by some religious, legalistic system. Continuing here in verse 9, Matthew 12. "Now when he had departed from there, he went into their synagogue. And behold, there was a man who had a withered hand, and they asked him, saying, 'Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath?' that they might accuse him. And then he said to them, 'What man is there among you who has one sheep, and if it falls into a pit on the Sabbath, will not lay hold of it and lift it out? Of how much more value then is a man than a sheep? Therefore, it is lawful to do good on the Sabbath.' And then he said to the man, 'Stretch out your hand.' And he stretched it out, and it was restored as whole as the other. And then the Pharisees went out and plotted against him how they might destroy him. He says it's lawful to heal. It's lawful to do good on the Sabbath. Again, an example of Sabbath. The Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. And Jesus is demonstrating here that removing a burden, in this case, the healing of an affliction, it's lawful on the Sabbath. It's covered by the law of love. The showing of mercy to someone in need superseded the ordinances around strict Sabbath observance. It's lawful to love, to tend to the acute needs of others. Again, a direct refutation of the burdensome legalistic application of the rules and regulations common in what the Jewish religion had become. Note, this is not a refutation of the requirement to keep the Sabbath, to rest from our labors. It was a contrast to the rigid relationship or lack of relationship that existed in that system at that time. Mercy, service over ritual. It's radical. It was radical for that time. Turn, if you would, to John 5. This wasn't an isolated event. Jesus took many, many opportunities to drive these ideas home. John 5, we'll read this in verses 1 through 15. John 5, verse 1. And after this, there was a feast of the Jews, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. Now there is in Jerusalem by the sheep gate a pool, which is called in Hebrew Bethesda, having five porches. In these lay a great multitude of sick people, blind, lame, paralyzed, waiting for the moving of the water. For an angel went down at a certain time into the pool and stirred up the water. And then whoever stepped in first after the stirring of the water was made well of whatever disease he had. Now a certain man was there who had infirmity 38 years. And when Jesus saw him lying there and knew that he already had been in that condition a long time, he said to him, "Do you want to be made well?" And the sick man answered him, "Sir, I have no man to put me in the pool when the water is stirred up, but while I am coming, another steps down before me." So Jesus said to him, "Rise, take up your bed and walk." And immediately the man was made well, took up his bed, and he walked. And that day was the Sabbath. The Jews therefore said to him who was cured, It is the Sabbath, it is not lawful for you to carry your bed. And he answered them, "He who made me well said to me, take up your bed and walk." Then they asked him, "Who is the man who said to you, take up your bed and walk?" But the one who was healed did not know who it was, for Jesus had withdrawn, a multitude being in that place. And afterward Jesus found him in the temple and said to him, "See, you have been made well. Sin no more, lest a worse thing come upon you." The man departed and told the Jews that it was Jesus who had made him well, and for this reason the Jews persecuted Jesus and sought to kill him, because he had done these things on the Sabbath. But Jesus answered them, "My Father has been working until now, and I have been working." Wow. Again, what a statement. Does any doubt about who Jesus claimed to be? It wasn't here. We don't find it here. "My Father has been working until now, and I have been working." God is continually working his plan that he purposed since the beginning, his love and his service to his creation, to his children. It doesn't take a rest. It's unconditional. And this shouldn't be interpreted by us as Jesus, again, giving green light to perform physical labor on the Sabbath. That's not what he was saying here. It's important to note that though Jesus did, you know, on a number of occasions perform acts of healing on the Sabbath, he wasn't advocating that the Sabbath should be dedicated solely to healing, to that purpose. Mark 1:32, I won't turn there, but you can read it on your own, indicates that there was a large number that were brought to Jesus for healing. They were brought after sunset, typically, when the Sabbath had ended. And it's clear from a reading of the Gospels that Christ nor his disciples made a practice of performing or advocating that others perform physical labor on the Sabbath day. What he was modeling here is that physical labor in of itself, if it serves an important need in the moment, is not unlawful on the Sabbath. Taking care of your needs or the needs of others, if you're unable to be completed beforehand or to wait till after, it's permissible. It's covered under the larger principle of love. It's the principle we would apply in any number of situations that you can probably think of many yourself. Someone needs help getting their car started on the Sabbath so they can get to church. They change a flat tire or so they could go to church or ministering to someone's needs who are in distress. Those are all covered under the law of love, as we know. Christ used all of these opportunities that presented themselves around the very visible observance of the Sabbath to demonstrate God's love in giving his people this day. And the reason he gave them challenged the very foundations of the religious system that he lived in. Everything Jesus did around the Sabbath was meant to reorient their thinking, their understanding, away from compulsion and toward relationship. Turn, if you would, over to Hebrews 3. Hebrews 3. If the Israelites, the Jews return, the Israelites themselves at Sinai, or the Jews having had returned from captivity, if they truly would have comprehended the amazing love of the one who created them and who desired them to enter in relationship with him, a God who had provided time for his children to enter into focused fellowship with him and fellowship with their brothers and sisters as a family, how would they reject that if they truly comprehended it, if they truly understood it? How could they have turned it into something it's not, a tool of control, a means of demonstrating their own righteousness, or a means of judging others they perceive to be unrighteous? How could they have done that to something so clearly meant as an instrument of love, of healing, and of relationship? How could they not delight in that, and why would they not want to enter into that kind of rest? The answer is, they couldn't fully comprehend it because they weren't led by God's Spirit. As we know, their mind wasn't open to that. They were led by the flesh. They were carnal. And the carnal human nature is selfish and self-serving. And because, as we read in Romans 8:7, by nature the carnal mind is enmity against God, for it is not subject to the law of God, nor indeed can be. So that's where they were at. They could not comprehend the love of God. It wasn't in their heart, their mind, to do so. But here's the thing. It applies to you and I as well. You and I, who though we have and are led by God's Spirit, you and I who have been released from bondage into the liberty, who have entered in the rest into relationship and all that that entails for our lives, both now and into the future, we still battle this earthly flesh, don't we? We still battle our carnal human nature. And because of that, we, like they, could be tempted to one of those two reactions, those two ditches that we discussed, to reject or to abuse what God has given, this day that God has intended to be holy, to be a blessing. Here in Hebrews chapter 3, Christians, you and I, were exhorted to be wary not to let that happen. And it's somewhat long, but it's important. And so I'm going to go through it. Bear with me here. Hebrews 3, verse 12. We read in Hebrews 3, verse 12, "Beware, brethren, lest there be in any of you an evil heart of unbelief in departing from the living God, but exhort one another daily, why it is called today, lest any of you be hardened through the deceitfulness of sin. For we have become partakers of Christ if we hold the beginning of our confidence steadfast to the end, while it is said, today if you will hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as in the rebellion. For who having heard rebelled? Indeed, was it not all those who came out of Egypt led by Moses? Now with whom was he angry for 40 years? Was it not with those who sinned, whose corpses fell in the wilderness? And to whom did he swear and that they would not enter his rest, but to those who did not obey? And so we see that they could not enter in because of unbelief. Hebrews 4, verse 1, continuing. Therefore, since a promise remains of entering his rest, let us fear, lest any of you seem to have come short of it. For indeed the gospel was preached to us as well as to them, but the word which they heard did not profit them, not mixed with faith in those who heard it. For we who have believed do enter that rest. As he said, so I swore in my wrath, they shall not enter my rest, although the works were finished from the foundation of the world. For he has spoken in a certain place on the seventh day in this way, and God rested on the seventh day from all of his works. And again in this place, they shall not enter my rest. And since therefore it remains that some must enter it, and those to whom it was first preached did not enter because of disobedience, again he designates a certain day, saying in David, today, after such a long time, as has been said, today if you will hear his voice, do not harden your hearts. For if Joshua had given them rest, then he would not afterward have spoken of another day. There remains therefore a rest for the people of God. For he who has entered his rest has himself also ceased from his works, as God did from his. Let us therefore be diligent to enter that rest, lest anyone fall according to the same example of disobedience. For the word of God is living and powerful and sharper than any two-edged sword, piercing even to the division of soul and spirit and of joints and marrow, and is a discerner of the thoughts and the intents of the heart. And there is no creature hidden from his sight, but all things are naked and open to the eyes of him to whom we must give account. So you and I, like Israel, we can be tempted. We can be tempted and we can become deceived and fall into the same pattern of unbelief that they fell into. The same hardness of heart. And maybe like them, we can end up over time beginning to go through the motions. That hardness comes from a heart that gradually stops believing, that falls out of trusting in him, trusting in relationship, and one that can cause us over time to begin to neglect his commandments, including his Sabbath, to treat it lightly and not as holy as it is, as it was intended to be, or to just, as I said, go through the motions, turning them into kind of a check-the-box list of religious do's and don'ts, where it becomes about demonstrating our own righteousness, not his. In closing, turn, if you would, over to Isaiah 58. Isaiah 58. Both of these ditches, rejecting or abusing God's holy Sabbath or any of his commands, they're a defilement of the true intent of what our God intended. Both represent falling short of entering into his rest, of entering into this relationship, because both fall short of understanding and comprehending the love of God, the God that gave them to us for our good. Here in Isaiah 58, verse 13, we read, Isaiah 58, verse 13, if you turn away your foot from the Sabbath, from doing your pleasure on my holy day, and you call the Sabbath a delight, the holy day of the Lord honorable, and shall honor him, not doing your own ways, nor finding your own pleasure, nor speaking your own words, then you shall delight yourself in the Lord, and I will cause you to ride on the high hills of the earth, and feed you with the heritage of Jacob your father. The mouth of the Lord has spoken. You know, this and other scriptures that we've shared today focus and center around the observance of the Sabbath command, because that's the context within which Christ was teaching and in demonstrating what entering into that rest looks like. But it really applies to all the commandments of God. It can be expanded to all of them that he's given to us. They're all for our good. They're all to guide us. And our God's desire is that you and I would delight ourselves in them. As we approach the Passover, I think it would benefit me, it'd benefit all of us to examine, has the reason for doing the things that I do, Has it changed? Has it changed? Has the practice of my faith to any degree strayed across the line over time from resting in relationship to a practice of duty to one of merely religion? And to any degree that might be true, let us who are his children once again resolve to be diligent to enter that rest fully. To be diligent to delight in and grow in relationship and all that means, and all the things that are available through that relationship with our God and that should be shared among his people and as part of his family. A desire for hope, for healing, for joy in having been released from spiritual bondage. The peace and spiritual restoration that comes from ceasing in our own labor, in our own works, and for ourselves and for others, and for resting and trusting in him, both in this life and in the one to come. And when we approach it that way, the way God intended, as a means of deepening that relationship with him, then we're able to fully enter in the rest that he provides. We're able to fully enter into relationship. And it's in that kind of a Sabbath, in such a law, we can truly find our rest. And in such a rest, we can truly delight.